Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Our state fair is a great state fair. Don't miss it, don't even be late. It's dollars to donuts that our state fair is the best state fair in our state.
From state to state, county to parish, it's fair season. Time to bring out the 4-H Blue Ribbon winning Jersey cows, eat everything fried on a stick, enjoy the musical stylings of your neighbors on the fiddle, and the hog calling of the pros. From barrel racing to life-size sculptures of cows made entirely of butter, the American Fair is an affair all to its own. This hour on Point, come along with us to the fair. You can join the conversation. What is it about a fair that brings you back year after year? What's your favorite fair-fried delicacy or stomach-turning ride? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining me now in La Crosse, Wisconsin, is Drake Hokanson, professor at Winona State University, where he teaches photography and journalism, and he's co-author with his wife, Carol Kratz, of Purebred and Homegrown, America's County Fairs. Welcome, Drake.
Thank you.
And also joining us from Sacramento, California, is Stephen Chambers, who is executive director of the Western Fairs Association. It's a nonprofit trade association serving the fair industry throughout the Western United States and Canada. Hello, Stephen.
Well, hello, Jackie. You played my favorite song. It's still making me laugh. Our state fair.
Yeah, I would imagine in your job you hear it quite often.
Yeah, it was funny. There was just an exhibit at the California State Fair, which closed on Sunday, about state fairs and county fairs, and that was the one movie they had, and they're running on a loop. So I heard that song a lot.
Well, I am fascinated by the whole notion. I mean, I have to say that I am a fellow Wisconsinite, Drake. I grew up in the southeastern part of the state, and fairs are just a big part of our family life, but it looks like they are for so many Americans. You and your wife spent 10 years going to hundreds of fairs. Why?
Well, we did indeed. We got fascinated with them by virtue of the fact that they seem to be this wonderful expression of what's the very best about American culture. At a time when we're worried about debt ceilings and defaults, it's really nice to think about something so wonderful as the fair on a hot day. And these fairs have you know, deeper meaning. They go way back in our history, American history. We found that no one had written a book on the American County Fair since about 1935. That is a book that really dealt with the subject in total. We decided it was time to do it, and besides, we thought we could think of nothing more fun than spending our summer vacations for a decade traveling around the country, going to fairs and gathering stories and interviewing kids and carnies and just absorbing this great part of American culture.
And how many do you think you did get to?
Well, we kept count, but I think we lost at some point. I think it's around 100. I know we were in 35 states, and even today, as somebody asks us, well, did you go to the such-and-such fair, our response is invariably, not yet.
Stephen Chambers, it seems as if barrel racing and that sort of thing and livestock showing, I don't see a decrease in popularity, possibly the opposite.
No, it's an exciting time for fairs. You know, fairs celebrate the accomplishments of ordinary citizens. I mean, and, you know, 200 years ago when fairs started, that was all about agriculture. But today, it's everything from websites to skateboarding to, I was at the Orange County Fair last week and they were having all these pogo contests. And let me tell you, the pogo sticks of today, they're like these hydraulic things. The ones I remember when I were kids, you could only go about 6 inches in the air. These kids are going like 15 feet in the air. I mean, it's just fun to see the whole community get out and essentially celebrate itself.
Mm-hmm. Reminds me, I once pogo stick to the tune of Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious with the Economowoc Legion Band.
So, we can get you in a contest at the Orange Fair. You might be the winner.
I might, you know, 15 feet there. I don't know. It's a bit high for me. You talk about this, Drake, as a really, really enduring institution that cuts across a lot, you know, everything that you just also mentioned, political lines and gender and age, and that it takes us back to our past. It takes us to an agrarian past that very few people get a chance to see, but that seems to be ever more prized.
Well, it is, and as Steve knows, the American Agricultural Fair has a 200-year history. This is essentially 2011 is the 200th anniversary of the modern American Agricultural Fair, and remarkably enough, it hasn't changed a great deal in those 200 years. And it harkens back to this idea of it's a very Jeffersonian idea and something very much in the basic fabric of our country that we are an agrarian nation. Even though most of us live in suburbs and cities and places now, we still think of ourselves as an agrarian nation. If you look at the example I like is if you look at the calendar that the bank hands out, you know, and banks around the country hand out these nice scenic calendars if you're an account holder, the pictures on the calendar are almost always of rural scenes. They're of, you know, barns in Vermont and waving wheat and in Kansas. You know, occasionally the Tetons in our great national parks, but they generally aren't suburbs where we live. Generally, they're not as visual, and I think this is evidence that we still think of ourselves very much as rural agricultural people. The Jeffersonian yeoman farmer who becomes a learned man or woman today and makes decisions in a democracy. There's something very fundamental about our culture that still retains this thread that we see exhibited all over at the fair, as is true of many of the visitors to the fair. Of course, mm-hmm. The majority of the visitors at the fair are people who don't make their living in agriculture, as Steve points out. So there's something very... something that rings a bell for all of us at the fair.
I just want to quote from your own book, Purebred and Homegrown, America's County Fairs. In the barns are bleating sheep, slumbering hogs, fuzzball rabbits, lavish chickens dressed for an Edwardian ball. I mean, like, I really need to see that. Never the stew pot and not even llamas. Implacable, they ignore all passersby. And believe it or not, in 2007, the Minnesota State Fair introduced a llama costume contest where people dress their pet llamas up as brides, tooth fairies, clowns, giraffes, tractors. Here's Dan Whitaker, the show's superintendent, talking about how that began.
I think it's just that they're so handleable that people go, oh, let's see if he'll wear this just for the heck of it. And all of a sudden they find out he'll wear a hat and he'll wear this. And all of a sudden, hey, let's put a big costume on him. And it just keeps going and going and going. And now, hey, let's compete, you know.
Stephen Chambers, I don't think llama riding are yet a part of Western fairs, are they?
Well, you know,
oh, please tell me no.
Busting. You can bring your kids and they can, you know, race sheep across an arena. But no, it's amazing the interaction of people with animals. I mean, as that's evolved tremendously in the last 200 years from, you know, simply livestock to there's not the bright lines there used to be between livestock and pets. You know, when a lot of fairs are used as the properties because they house animals, there are a relocation during, you know, various disasters, floods, rain, fires, and stuff. And when they had big fires in Southern California, they opened up the San Diego fairgrounds to people who couldn't go to Qualcomm because pets weren't allowed. And it was like Noah's Ark. I mean, people have turtles and zebras. And, you know, they expected horses, cats, and dogs, which they got a lot of. But wow, were there people have a lot of interesting animals at home. Let's put it that way.
But you're an established livestock judge. I mean, do you mind that the line has been crossed into domestic pets, or do you think that's okay? And I have a follow-up question because I want to know how you do judge livestock.
Well, you know, that'll be for John Alkire, I believe, who you guys have been connected with. I'm a livestock witness, but not a livestock judge.
Well, but and appreciate
it. Favorite livestock are racehorses.
But I think that, you know, one of the areas of expansion in terms of competition, you know, the elusive blue ribbon, that, you know, that's kind of the heart of what fairs are in our society, which is people, you know, showing off the best of what they can do in their community. You know, even 50 years ago, all the 4-H and FFA, the youth programs, were around production animals. Today, 4-H and FFA have, you know, dogs and cats and, you know, and other animals. And I just think that reflects the reality that a lot of kids these days don't have the property or the backyard big enough. You know, hey, Mom, I'm bringing home a cow, isn't going to go over big in the suburbs. And so, you know, service dog training and all those other things end up showing off at the fair. It's really cool.
Let's go out on a livestock competition. You talk about this being such a highlight at the county fairs, Drake, in your book. Here's the auctioneer for the 2010 Grand Champion Steer of the Illinois State Fair. The prize-winning steer was shown by Brandon Wyatt, 18 years old, of the Royal Ag 4-H Club, and it sold for $35,000.
34,5, 34,6, 34,7, 34,8, 34,9, $35,000. Right here, got 35. You got to be 35.
And Stephen Chambers, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook. It's state fair season, and we're talking fried food on a stick, 4-H Blue Ribbon prize winners, carnival rides, and hog calling contests. And speaking of hog calling, here's Alex Stockfleet of Marion, Iowa. He won the first place adult division at the 2008 Iowa State Fair.
Step over up, piggy! I got your pork chop! Sweet! Give me a little pork chop, pork chop, pork chop! Sweet! Give me a little pork chop, pork chop, pork chop!
Well, if you're not on the floor, you can join the conversation. Are you a blue ribbon contender at your local fair? Give us a call and tell us what it takes to win. We're talking with Drake Hokanson, co-author of Purebred and Homegrown, America's County Fairs, and professor of mass communication at Winona State University. Have you ever seen a pig calling contest, Drake?
We have not seen a pig calling contest, but we have seen a lot of very interesting contests across the way. One of our favorites is sheepdog trials, which is certainly less good for radio, but is one of the most interesting things you'll see. And you see it at a lot of fairs in the West, where people train and use sheepdogs to keep sheep gathered or disperse them or to move them in the mountain pastures during the summer. And these events, you'll see a bleacher full of a grandstand full of people all leaning forward, absolutely dead silent, as a neighbor runs their sheepdog through a very complex set of trials, herding a group of usually about 8 sheep, and the tension is palpable. I mean, it's like a pro football game. The energy invested in these things is no less than you find in some great contest that you see on ESPN.
Drake, I don't know. I just have to say, personally, I think I'd go for the pig calling before the sheep shearing, but we may hear from sheep shearers who disagree.
well, this here we're talking about sheep herding. That is, these sheep dogs. They will herd these sheep through these obstacles. It's really remarkable.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Joining us now from Des Moines, Iowa, is Sarah Pratt, the butter cow sculptor of the Iowa State Fair. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks. Good to talk to you, Jackie.
Now, butter cow sculpting and butter sculpting in general have really been quite a feature in Iowa. Would you tell us just a little bit about that, please?
Sure. This year we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the first butter cow here at our fair. And so it's been a long tradition, and there have been many other things sculpted other than the cow, but the cow has been a tradition for 100 years.
And I think one has to say, and why is that?
Well, it started for lots of reasons. I think they were, at the turn of the century, there were lots of different food sculptures happening. And I think one of the reasons was to kind of entice people to the Midwest and say, we have so much food, we have so much abundance, come to the Midwest, where we have enough food that we can sculpt and build things out of it. And then it kind of turned into something to promote the dairy industry. And, you know, over the years it evolved into just a really wonderful tradition that people enjoy coming and seeing and just reliving that time gone by, so to speak.
And you've learned your craft at the foot of a very great butter sculptor in Iowa who recently passed away, correct?
That's right. And Norma Duffy Lyon was my mentor, and I apprenticed with her for 15 years until she retired in 2006 and named me her successor.
What's the most challenging butter sculpture you've made?
Oh, wow. Well, before Duffy retired, it was the year we celebrated the 150th year of the fair. I believe it was 2004. And she was asked to sculpt herself in butter to commemorate her contributions to the fair. And at that time, she decided it wasn't something that she wanted to do. So they called me. And at that time, I was still very doubting my skills, and I hadn't quite embraced the idea that I was able to do sculptures on my own. And it was difficult, not only sculpting my mentor, but sculpting my mentor in her presence and doing it when I didn't necessarily have that confidence yet. But she really built my confidence, and she really changed my life in that sense, to have somebody believe in you so fully and to kind of push you towards something that maybe you don't feel successful in at the time was very instrumental in my life.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Sarah Pratt, Butter Cow Sculptor.
Thanks.
Let's go to a call now. Nathalie from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is up. Welcome to On Point, Nathalie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
And
I am so excited about this conversation about the state fair. Some of my best memories from graduate school are actually from the Great Minnesota Get-Together up in St. Paul. I entered into Luther Seminary a few years ago, and I found the Minnesota State Fair to be the best way to get to know my professors and the neighbors, and it seemed like everyone in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and from all over the state arrived.
Did you have a favorite dish?
Oh, my goodness. They had something called pig liquors and chocolate-covered bacon.
Pig liquors?
Pig liquors.
It's pig liquors.
Pig liquors, which is chocolate-covered bacon, and it was so tasty and so bad for you.
I think it has to be bad from you. Otherwise, it doesn't count. Thank you very much, Nathalie. And joining us now from Fresno, California, is John Alkiri. He's a longtime livestock judge at state and local fairs across the country. Welcome, John.
How are you today? Thank you for the call.
Well, thank you for taking time out of what seems to be a very busy schedule. I was wondering, having grown up around horses, my brother's a calf roping champion, actually, and a farrier, do you think that more young people are participating in fairs than ever, or have you seen a drop-off as the culture speeds up?
Well, I think it depends on the area that you're from. Each fair has its own special, unique components, and I think every county and local fair has a little different opportunities and things to offer. So it depends on where you're from and location. But in my opinion, in some areas I've seen an influx in the livestock industry and the showing part of it, and I've also seen closer to the rural areas, higher influence and influx in numbers in the smaller animals.
We heard
it's
a little
easier to take care of them.
Because it's easier to take care of them, cheaper to feed them. And do you see kids participating from suburban areas who are not necessarily country kids?
You're seeing more and more of that. And you're seeing a lot more of the smaller animal projects, again, because in the suburban areas you can have rabbits and cavies and hamsters and birds, pigeons, and keep those pretty much in town. Or, you know, it's pretty difficult to keep a steer or a hog or a lamb in your backyard if you're in town.
I kind of hope that nobody's asked you to judge a hamster, though.
No, thank God. I don't have any training in that area at all.
So, John, what are some of the large animals that you judge?
Well, the largest, obviously, is the beef, and we do a lot of sheep and swine, and then on occasion we even judge some horse shows as well.
And who participates in the horse shows?
Well, you get a wide range of exhibitors. You go from 4-H and FFA all the way up to the open professional shows.
We played a clip earlier of a young man who had sold a steer for $35,000, raising those animals, selling them off. That has to be a real achievement for young people.
It is, and I think it is one of the components of showing livestock that is so important to raising a child, because I remember when my children were involved heavily. That was how they had their first opportunity to go down and get a bank loan. That was the first opportunity to have a checkbook and set a budget. And it also taught them to go out and market their product, go out and talk to potential buyers and try to get them to the sale. Because not everyone can be the grand champion. So you need to make sure that you have some buyers there to support your year-long projects.
Well, John, thank you so much for being with us. And I think I mispronounced your name, John Alkiri. It's been a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks.
Oh, the pleasure is mine, and thank you for your call.
Let's go to another call. It's County Fair Hour on Point. We're speaking with Ellen Ann Geisel from Pueblo, Colorado. Welcome to the show, Ellen Ann.
Hey, Jackie.
And we might say we do have an acquaintance. And you are an apron maven.
Thank you for that title. I appreciate it.
You just got back from exhibiting your aprons, and you have been doing that at a lot of state and county fairs. Tell us about that.
Well, I just participated at the inaugural Denver County Fair. They have never had one before, and it was the last 4 days of July. It was a most unusual fair as far as the other fairs I've been to. It had lots of unique sections, like a holistic section that included a psychic, to the craft section where I displayed my apron collection, to a drag queen competition for the title of Miss Denver County Fair.
Wow. Dre Kokanson, you're still with us?
I am indeed.
You know, the way that the county fairs, the competitions are getting expanded is mind-boggling.
It is, and that's really the beauty of the fair, that there's this sense of tradition and competition that started with the very first fair 200 years ago, and we continue this tradition. And the people who put on and operate these fairs are very innovative. They're very, very wonderful entrepreneurs who have these great ideas about how we can express our own community's ideas and values through competition. And people invest a lot in this competition, good-natured competition, but very fun, and it brings people to every fair in the country.
Ellen Ann, when you were exhibiting your aprons, you said this is the first time that Denver County had had this type of fair. Did people ask you about the handicraft or about collecting? I recently purchased a finger puppet that somebody had crocheted, and she said she'd exhibited those in her county fair. So apparently textiles of any kind are legitimate objects for competition at county fairs.
You know, I look at anything that was handmade like that, where you had to sit and quietly watch your number of stitches as the organic tie to the heart of a fair, because you had to tie on an apron originally to, you know, plant the seed that would grow into the goods that you were going to can to enter, to care for the baby livestock or the chicks that you would eventually enter, you know, into some kind of competition. The carnies wear aprons to make change. The vendors, you know, tie one on themselves. There was even a craft booth put on by a business in Denver called Fancy Tagger that had speed crocheting contests. And a speed, what else did they do? Well, a speed sewing contest. They actually set up sewing machines.
Wow.
I've never seen anything like it. I personally sponsored a supper hauler.
A supper hauler? How did what is that?
Well, I've seen pig haulers. That's pretty big out where I live. And they are such fun that I was moved to sponsor the supper hauler, which is folks line up, tie on an apron, and call the family to the table. My very favorite, Jackie, was this little boy who we tied on an apron, and the ties went around him three times. He was such a little guy. And he took the microphone and put it right against his mouth, and he hollered, "Mama, I heard you."
I love it.
Ellen Ann, adorable.
Thank you so much. Ellen Ann Geisel, she is the author of The Apron Book. Let's take a comment from our website. Gary Trees writes that the Mississippi Valley Fair starts today. Then they'll all pack up and move on to the Iowa State Fair. While the Iowa State Fair is the bigger and more well-known of the fairs in Iowa, I've never been to it, mainly because the Mississippi Valley Fair is a staging ground and test run for many of its attractions and events. Close to home, he says, and close to home, that means a lot to fairgoers, doesn't it, Dre Kokanson?
It does indeed, and one of the things that we observed in our travels is that most people in most parts of the country know their own fair pretty well if they participate or help organize it, but an awful lot of people don't go to other fairs around the country. And we have, Carol and I have urged people as they travel in the United States during fair season, which starts usually the second week or so in July and runs often through September in the South, that they check the websites before they leave and find some fairs in the direction that they might be going, in hopes of stopping in and getting a really intense and wonderful local flavor of some place that they might not know very well. There are fairs all over the country, some 2,200 agricultural fairs throughout the country, and you really learn a lot about this great country of ours by attending a few.
You wrote 2,200 fairs and just over 3,000 counties, so all but 800 counties in the U.S.
Approximately, yes. Some counties have two. There's a small county in western Nebraska. Oh, I think the population of the entire county isn't over 4,000 people, and they have had a feud for generations about which is the official fair in the county.
Taking another call from our website, Michael says, I frequented my share of state and county fairs in West Virginia, Ohio, and Maryland. It's a lot of fun, but the fairs seem to exhibit the worst-case scenarios of food, in that it's something of a horror show of dietary choices. Fried fried food, high salt, high sugar. You know, in your book, you talked about taking vegetable stops.
Yes, we did find that, you know, when we were going from fair to fair to fair, we'd sometimes be at as many as three fairs in a week, that we camped with the 4-H kids and the carnies out in the back lot, pitched a tent so we could be involved in the fair at all hours of the day. But we found that one could not live on fair food alone. We brought, let's just say we had a cooler and we had a lot of salad and so on. But you do find at a lot of the bigger fairs, there's lighter kinds of meals coming along. But frankly, part of the appeal of the fair is that it's a very different event. It happens once a year, and most of us think, well, we can indulge in that wonderful high-fat ice cream or those incredible French fries that we wait all year to eat. And I think in food terms, what happens at the fair stays at the fair. We get to eat all those wonderful things. We had fried chicken at a fair in Indiana, a huge line of people going out of this pavilion to get fried chicken. And I sat down with a plate of fried chicken, and Carol across the table from me, and I bit into it, and I said, this is like the fried chicken that my great-grandmother used to make in Iowa. And we inquired a little bit about it, and of course it was fried in lard. It was fabulous chicken, but I wouldn't want to do that at home on a routine basis.
We are going to begin a call with Beth Howard from Eldon, Iowa, because, Beth, would you ever fry anything in lard?
No, I don't use lard in my pie crust. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. Beth Howard is a pie judge at the Iowa State Fair this year and has her own small business, America Needs More Pie.
It's my website is The World Needs More Pie, and I run the Pitchfork Pie Stand out of the American Gothic House in Eldon, Iowa.
Well, why do you think that pie is so important to a fair?
Pie is, I think, the basis of all fairs. Forget the cows and the pigs. I think the new state fair is complete without pie. It's a long-standing tradition and definitely one of the main competition categories of state fairs nationwide.
When the sun goes down at the end of the day, and the lights come up on the midway, and the crazy carnies start talking trash, hey man, it's three tries for a dollar, you can win that baseball cap. And there's no describing how free it feels when you ride the zipper and Ferris wheel at the state fair. It'll be all right at the state fair. Well, I'll see you there tonight. It'll be all right at the state fair. Well, I'll see you there tonight.
You're late.
On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. You're hearing Sarah Stallman of Kirksville, Missouri, second place winner in yodeling at the 2009 Iowa State Fair. We're talking the great American fair tradition. Come with us and stay too long at the fair. We're talking with Drake Hokanson, co-author of the Purebred and Homegrown America County Fairs book. We were also talking just before the break with caller Beth Howard from Eldon, Iowa, who has a small business, The World Needs More Pie, and judges pies. And Beth, I want to ask you how you do that and what kinds.
How do I judge pie?
Yeah. Tasting it,
well,
eating it, flakiness?
I actually have a judging rule where I limit myself to maybe just one or two bites, and then I know if a pie is really, really good if I end up taking like four or five bites. That's kind of the ultimate test, I think, of judging.
And do people who bring pies to fairs, are there categories like lemon meringue, apple, blueberry, or?
Absolutely. Gosh, the Iowa State Fair, I think, has at least 20 categories, and even within one of those categories, there are at least 20 categories. So it's layers upon layers of pie flavors. There's prepared pie crust, like you can do Keebler or Pillsbury crust. There's the apple pie category, of course. And this year at the fair, I'm judging the Oh My, It's Peach Pie category. And well, that's one of my favorites to judge because they give the pie away to the audience afterward.
Which is reminding me that listeners should submit their favorite pictures of themselves at these county fairs. Thanks for joining us, Beth. We are talking. We are talking about the Purebred and Homegrown American County Fair, and with author Drake Hokanson, and you, our callers, thinking about peach pie, thinking about what might go with it. What comes to your mind, Drake?
Well, I'm sort of like like Sherman's March to the Sea. When I get to any county fair, I pay no attention to food groups starting with a main meal first and then going to dessert. I just show up at any food booth and buy whatever they have. I'm a complete omnivore when it comes to fair food. So anything goes with pie. And of course, as Beth points out, pie is this. I suspect there were pies at the first modern American fair, and there have been pies at every fair since. And it's almost, if you look at some of the fair posters around, there'll almost always be a cow, a Ferris wheel, and a pie on them. So she's absolutely right at the deep tradition of pies at fairs. So we couldn't really have a really great fair without good pie.
Well, let's talk about a new food group that might give the observer who thought there was too much strange food nightmares. Mark Zabel, he is a Texas State Fair food vendor. Mark, you have invented fried beer?
I did invent fried beer.
Oh, right. And you're okay with that?
I'm totally okay with it.
Tell us about it. I believe it's winning a lot of awards at the Texas State Fair.
It did win the Big Tex Choice Award last year at the fair. I was able to find a way to encapsulate liquid beer inside of a pretzel and deep fry it, to where when you bit into it, it's kind of like the old squirt gum where you bit into it and it gushed in your mouth. Same concept.
So how is it that one day you said, you know what I need to do? Fry some beer and enter it at the county fair.
You know, I had to come up with something unusual because I wanted my trophy.
I see. And it was a state fair, I should point out. Where
it was. It's actually the State Fair of Texas is the largest fair in the country.
Does Texas have a lot of county fairs, Drake?
Well, it has somewhat fewer than many other states. The really very fair-minded states, I think, in the country include the Northeast through the Midwest and then along the West Coast, Oregon and California and Washington. In the South, there are many, many other kinds of food-related festivals. And, of course, in the summer in Texas, it's pretty hot to have a fair. And most of the fairs you find in the South are September or even March fairs. So the fair tradition got a little less strong a hold in the South, largely because the fairs were moving west with settlers just at the time before the Civil War. And I think there were a lot of ideas that didn't penetrate the Mason-Dixon line very well.
Hmm. Mark, what's been the reaction? Are you going to keep doing this?
I've already entered my two new fried products for the fair for this year for the cook-off, and of course I can't divulge what those are yet. But
you can't.
I think
I'm deeply disappointed, sir.
Get more press than fried beer did.
Well, you know, you make me think that you're part of the great atomization tradition in taking foods apart, and I hope you'll continue that in your next entry.
I will, absolutely.
Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Joe from Stowe, Vermont. Welcome to On Point, Joe.
Hi, Jackie. You're really striking a nostalgic nerve today, I got to tell you.
We are. Yes, we're nice. Pumping that one for all it's worth, I think. So you grew up in Indiana?
I did. I grew up in Indiana in the 60s, and 4-H was our way of life in the summertime. Our entire family, it just revolved our whole life around that fair that happened at the end of the summer, and everything built toward it, you know, from the projects of agriculture, which were my pigs, my brother's sheep, my brother and my cattle, my horse, to the foods categories where I actually won grand champion.
What did you win for?
Pizza.
Oh, dessert pizza? Did you say?
Disgusting.
You know, I saw that in New York, and I thought it was something new. Who knew?
Oh, no, 60s. Yeah, it was new there. It really blew the judges away. I remember thinking, really? Really? You gave me a ribbon for this?
Well, okay. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that memory, Joe. And we really need to remember the rides at the State Fair. And joining us now is Tom Atkins. He's joining us from Great Falls, Montana, the Montana State Fair. You're actually at the fair, Tom?
Yes, I am, Jackie.
Wow, cool. So tell us what sort of rides you are providing. You are co-owner and operator of the Mikey Thomas Carnival.
That's right. We have rides for everybody, from little kids to the thrill rides, the zipper, the ejection seats. So something for everybody.
It's a lot to haul around, and I believe that Thomas Carnival has been hauling all that stuff around, Tom Atkins, since 1928.
That's correct. Our company was started in 1928 by actually my wife's grandfather. So we've been doing it a long time.
So you said that you have rides for everyone. You mentioned the zipper. Tell me about the zipper. I'm trying to remember that ride. I know I've been on it.
Oh, I'm sure you have. Just about everybody, if they've been to a fair in their teenage years, has been on the zipper. Like all rides, it goes around, but it also revolves you around the center of your body as you're going around. So it's a very popular ride.
Drake Hokanson, can you imagine a fair without rides?
Well, so the best fairs and the biggest fairs, of course, all have carnivals, and it's a very important part of the fair, and it's one of the historically very important components of the fair. But, of course, there are many small fairs around the country, really in all states, that are small enough that they don't have a carnival, and yet they have a very viable, good community fair. But we like the fairs that have the carnival because it adds the wonderful sound and the entertainment and brings the kids to the fair. It's a really important component of it.
We have a couple of comments from our website here. Julian, wonderfully nostalgic community celebration, but how few family farms are left considering that? Isn't this really a form of theme parkery? What do you think, Drake?
Well, it is a bit like a theme park, and yet it's most of them are a lot less expensive than a theme park, and they combine some elements that a theme park will not have. A theme park's desire is to simply give you a good time. But if you leave a good fair, especially your local fair, as you walk out the gate, you will have had a good time, but you will also probably, if it's a good fair, you'll probably think to yourself, I live in a good community. These are good people. Look what they've done. It's, as Steve Chambers pointed out, it's a celebration of the local community. There's something much deeper and much more important that goes on.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for being with us from Great Falls, Montana today and taking us out west.
Hi, you're welcome. My pleasure.
And speaking about West, let's go to Winnie from Bismarck, North Dakota, at the edge of the West. Welcome to On Point, Winnie.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you.
Thank you. So what's going on around Bismarck?
Our state fairs affect us in a little bit different way since our state is very agricultural, so it's not quite part of our past. It's still very active in our present, and those kids that are in the FFA are truly going to be the future farmers of America. But this year, we had an event happen. We had significant flooding in the state, and for the first time, at least in my memory, we had to cancel our state fair within about 2 weeks of when it was scheduled to happen. So everyone that worked so hard and the events, the music lineup, everything was just ended, and that was just a shock to all of us, who it feels like the entire state nearly turns out for this fair.
North Dakota really has struggled with flooding in recent years. Are there any thoughts to postponing it till the fall to try to restage it?
No, the best that could be done at that point, the rides were divided up between Bismarck and Fargo so that at least, you know, people were able to go to them. But the, you know, the other... Really, there is just not an area to house all of that activity, and school starts at the end of this month. So it's just not going to happen this year, unfortunately, with not only all the work that goes into preparation, but also the area certainly could have used that as a source of revenue.
Well, Winnie, thank you for reminding us how important this tradition is, how much money it can also generate, money, jobs, activity, all kinds of things. Thanks for calling in from Bismarck.
You're welcome.
And let's take another call now. David is calling from Chesapeake, Virginia. Welcome to On Point, David.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, you know, when I think of the fairs and what have you, I think of simplicity and the formation of our country. I mean, way back in the day, I mean, if you look at the Westerns, you can really see it. You know, but people migrated to central focal points within, you know, within the nation, and you know, and it kind of started an urban sprawl. You know, people would find these central places, and you know, where you didn't have a whole lot of buildings and things like that and structures around, and you know, and they would trade and sell things and have stories and cook and all kinds of other, you know, types of congregational type things, and the more that they did it in these, you know, particular places, they started to build towns. You know, they'd say, well, you know, we should start building permanent structures. And next thing you know, a town forms, and then it just kind of goes from there. And I think that as much as the fairs are, you know, today they try to hold that tradition, it's really not a tradition. It was more of just a way of life that started our whole entire civilization.
All right. Thank you, David. I don't know about starting our whole entire civilization, Drake Hokanson, but you do say that one of your requirements for what is a fair, the kind you're writing about, is that it have a permanent structure for livestock and other exhibits.
Well, they're more or less the permanent fairgrounds, which would generally include structures. And David makes a good point. The notion of people gathering for trade and for conviviality, of course, goes way, way back beyond the written record. And the American County Fair and State Fairs come out of that tradition as well, and enlarge on that. But it is true that most fairs do have fairgrounds, permanent structures, places where you can have the fair every year. And many of them turn these into exposition grounds where auto dealers might have large car sales. They might, in some rural communities, they might store campers and boats during the winter in these buildings. So these are often very much multi-purpose places now. It's really remarkable to see this change.
Let's take another call. We're talking the fair, county and state. Ivan is calling from Brattleboro, Vermont. Welcome to On Point, Ivan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that the small local fair near me is hosting a homebrew competition this year, which is, as far as I know, the first one they've ever done. And it's another aspect of, you know, people making their own things and pitting them against each other and just being excited about doing their own stuff and being part of a community.
Well, it sounds like a really good time, and I hope that the brew contest goes well.
Thank you.
And Roger is calling from West Hartford, Connecticut. Welcome to On Point, Roger.
Hello. Love your program today.
Thank you. What are you going to see at the fair? Which fair?
Oh, I love the World's Fair in Tunbridge, Vermont. They modestly call it the World's Fair.
Wait a minute. World's Fair?
World's Fair in Tunbridge, Vermont, yes.
Uh-huh. What's it got going?
It's got everything old that people used to have fun with before we had electronics.
Mm-hmm.
There are rides on the back of steam tractors. There are rides that are nothing but a big log with a couple of pieces of rope hanging onto it. There are period costumes and maple-flavored popcorn, maple-sweetened lemonade, maple everything in the world.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Thanks for giving a shout-out about that. Thanks, Roger. And let's take one more call. Sam is calling from Saxon, Wisconsin. Hello, Sam.
Hi. I'm calling to plug our local Iron County Fair in Wisconsin, the main feature of which, not the main feature, but the final main feature on Sunday is the draft horse pulling contest, where matched pairs of Belgian draft horses, Percherons, the big, huge draft horses that used to be used for farm work, they have a pulling contest to see how much weight these teams can pull, and it's fascinating to watch.
Well, you gave a plug for it, so now you have to tell us where Saxon and Iron County are, up north, right, in Wisconsin?
We border Lake Superior up. I don't know if you know where Hurley is.
I do, and it doesn't get any further north than that, and I haven't made the fair there, but, you know, there's a lot of time, right, Drake Hokanson?
That's true indeed, and I believe the Iron County Fair is going on late this week and through the weekend, if I remember the schedule correctly.
Yeah, that shouldn't be too far from you.
No, well, not too far.
Well, thank you, Sam, and thank you, to your co-author, your wife, Carol Kratz. The book is Purebred and Homegrown, America's County Fairs. I want to say you have wonderful pictures all throughout this book.
Thank you. We had a lot of fun writing the book. If you're going to do a book project, I figure you really ought to take on a subject that will be visual and interesting and keep you engaged for the years that it takes to produce it.
I'd agree. And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
On their tires and on their grills. You may live inside a townhouse in the suburbs, make your home.
You've always wanted a tractor you could call your very own. Minnesota, Minnesota, we are south of Manitoba. We are east of North Dakota, we got something really rare. It's fulfilling, entertaining, it's true culture you'll be gaining. Except no imitations, it's the fair. Now I need some relaxation or a soundproof room. A place to soak my aching feet that's quiet as a tomb. All that's left inside my pocket is some lint and half a pack of Tums. But next year you can bet now I'll be coming back. Minnesota, Minnesota, we are south of Manitoba. We are east of North Dakota, we got something really rare. It's fulfilling, entertaining, it's true culture you'll be gaining. There's deals and demonstrations, chicks and incubation, the whole population's at the fair.